time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Mary Woodward. Mary Woodward is a graduate in history from Whitman College and a former history teacher. She is a frequent lecturer and columnist on the history and politics of the exclusion, is active in the preservation of Bainbridge Island history, and has been a leader in the creation of the Bainbridge Island World War II K Internment and Exclusion Memorial. She is the daughter of the late Walt and Millie Woodward, and she is here to talk about her new book, In Defense of Our Neighbors, The Walt and Millie Woodward Story. Mary, thank you very much for spending time with us this morning.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Start out and tell us, what was the motivation in writing In Defense of Our Neighbors?
Well, initially it began as an attempt to reconfigure a scrapbook that one of the people who had been involved in the exclusion had kept over the years, of newspaper articles, primarily from the Bainbridge Review, which was my folks' newspaper. He had been, as a 17-year-old teenager, had been excluded from the West Coast along with some 120,000 other Nikkei, which is a word meaning a Japanese in America, and it includes both the first generation who were not allowed to become citizens and their children who were born here and were therefore citizens of the United States. They were all excluded from the West Coast of Washington, Oregon, and California, and also parts of Nevada, sent to, they were called by President Roosevelt, concentration camps. Throughout the next many decades, they became known as internment camps or relocation centers. They confined the Nikkei, and even though some were eventually released to go on work release or go to college or to join the military, none of the people were allowed to come back to their homes until after the as the war was beginning to close in 1944. There was a sizable Nikkei population on Bainbridge. About 10% of the population in 1941 were of Japanese descent. And my folks had just purchased the newspaper. They were fairly young themselves, in their early 30s. And they, when it was announced that these people were going to be sent away from their homes, they recognized that that was in violation of the Constitution, and they spoke out. And they also hired high school kids to report back from the camps. So Paul Otake, who was working as a part-time janitor at the Review, cleaning up after press night, they hired for $5.50 a month to send back news about who won the baseball game and who got married in camp, and the kind of chit-chatty news that was common in the 40s. In local papers. So there was a weekly presence in the Bainbridge Review throughout the duration of the war of the people my folks described as our neighbors who are away for a while. And this was totally in, I was going to say totally unique. I don't think it was absolutely unique, because there were some other newspapers that occasionally spoke out in opposition to this. But as far as a consistent stand against the exclusion of the Nikkei, the Bainbridge Review is the only one that I can find. And certainly the continued presence of the Nikkei within the community throughout the war is unique. And more than 50% of Bainbridge Islanders returned to the island, and that's considerably more than most. Places like Everett, Bellevue, Hood River, Oregon. There are many examples of communities like Bainbridge that had a substantial Nikkei population, where politicians and newspapers, excuse me, were actively working to initially send, as they called them, the Japs away. They didn't distinguish between Japanese Americans and the Japs we were fighting in the Pacific. And then on, as the war began to wind down, and it became apparent that they would be released, it all sprang up again in 1944, and there were politicians like Scoop Jackson and Warren Magnuson, who became Democratic heroes in Washington State who were actively working to keep, as they said, the Japs from returning. Henry Jackson, in particular, in Everett, was quite vocal. The Bellevue American, other newspapers that actively worked to keep the people from returning to their homes. And it was the opposite on Bainbridge, and it made a significant difference.
So your parents actually, they purchased the newspaper just like 2 months before the beginning?
They purchased it in 1940, but my father had been working as a reporter with the Seattle Times, and my mother had a child in the spring of 1940, so she was busy also, and it was not really part-time. They did put out the paper, but they finally committed themselves just a few months before Pearl Harbor to doing full-time, and my father stopped working at the Times, and they committed themselves to the Review.
And it was the day after Pearl Harbor that your father had a column that told people to, you know, take a deep breath and pretty much foretold what was going to be coming.
Exactly. And they were not different from a lot of other newspapers. Unfortunately, Bellevue American was not among those, but many local Washington State papers came out with similar editorials to what they pronounced, saying that let's be calm, let's not get panicky about this. These are our neighbors; they've been our neighbors. Let's just relax. Lots of other newspapers said that. What is really remarkable to me is that within 2 months, these papers were either silent about the exclusion or were actively supporting it, and I think that's, a remarkable turn of events, that this fear of the Nikkei essentially was manufactured within the 2 months, 2+ months between Pearl Harbor on December 7 and the exclusion order that was signed by Roosevelt in the middle of February. There were certain politicians, there were nativists, we think primarily from California, but there were folks in our backyard here who were saying the same thing. Very bigoted language that was used against, there is a long history of anti-Asian prejudice on the West Coast that goes back to when the Chinese first arrived in the middle of the 19th century. As soon as the Chinese and then shortly after that, the Japanese entered the labor force, they became an economic threat. And even though the entire West Coast pretty much was populated by immigrants who the Finns didn't understand the Italian immigrants, and the Slavs didn't understand the Swedes, but they somehow managed to communicate. But these people who came from Asia looked different, and that's what made the distinction. So immigrants from China and later from Japan were not allowed to become naturalized citizens. They were declared to be citizens immigrants ineligible to become citizens. They were officially designated, and our 1889 Constitution bars them from owning land. They couldn't vote. They really were set in a special designation for immigrants and had a heck of a time. It primarily was because of economics, particularly in California. They took land that nobody wanted. It was just garbage land, and in Oregon and Washington too. But they became very successful farmers within a short period of time. They had that heritage coming from Japan, and they were diligent in working and did become very successful farmers, and were a threat to the established agriculture community in California. And nativist organizations like the Native Sons of the Golden West, I love that name. There were also Native Daughters of the Golden West, and they didn't want anybody but white folks around. Prominent among those, the beginning of the war, was Earl Warren, who was running for governor of California and who was adamant about getting them out of California. And, of course, 10 years later, in 1954. He was Chief Justice on the Supreme Court when Brown versus Board of Education came down. That changed the ruling on segregated schools, and he's heralded as being a great civil rights jurist, but he had a different tack in the 40s. A lot of people that we respect today spoke out against the Japanese. They had no political voice, and they didn't have any economic power, so they were an easy target.
So then a period of time passed after the after December 7th, 1941, and at some point there, shortly thereafter, the president decided, he passed an order.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Executive Order 9066 was signed February 19, and what it did was effectively... It shifted the control of civilians on the west coast of the United States from the Justice Department to the Department of War and the Army, and gave, as it turned out, Lieutenant Colonel DeWitt was his name, gave him ultimate authority as to which civilians could remain on the west coast and which he could exclude. And that is, that's extraordinary. There was no declaration of martial law. And he had complete control. We had three enemies in World War II. There were a handful of Italian Americans and German Americans who were also interrogated. They were given the right to a hearing, and many of them were excluded from the coastline, but they weren't confined in the manner that Japanese Americans were. And it's interesting to note that on the East Coast at this time, German subs were routinely sinking our oil tankers from the Gulf of Mexico up all along the eastern seaboard, routinely, within a week, maybe four or five might be sunk. I mean, it was incredible. They had free run. We didn't have any Navy on the East Coast. Well, we didn't have much of a Navy anyway, but we didn't have any on the East Coast, and the Brits didn't have the capacity to come and help us. They had the run of the East Coast. And on the West Coast, there was one torpedo that came ashore in Oregon. There were lots and lots of rumors that there were all these subs out there, and these folks with their shortwave radios were telling them where to go, and they were planting their strawberry fields pointing toward Boeing. And we have a great homegrown historian, Jerry Elfendahl, on Bainbridge, and he tells a wonderful story and sort of challenges anyone to find a direction from Bainbridge Island that doesn't point in the direction of a military installation. When you think about Bremerton and the Seattle Shipyard and Boeing and all of, you know, so. But there were rumors, and they got headlines. Boy, they got headlines. And then when they were proven to be false, the retraction, if there was one, was buried. And the use of the word Jap is key. It was used in Guam. There was a terrible massacre early on in the war, and the headline was something like Japs massacre U.S. missionaries. And this was in the Seattle Times, and the same day, similar headline about how Japs are being ordered to register in Seattle. The same word was used. And if you just looked at the headlines, well, it's the same word. There must be the same people. And this confusion about they ought to, you know, go fight in their homeland. We're talking about American citizens who were confined for the most part. Two-thirds of the people who were confined were American citizens, and considerable proportion were children. They rounded up anyone who had 1/16th blood. It was the same that Hitler used for Jewish blood. They took kids from adoptive homes. They took whole homes for children who didn't have any family. They were all transported to Manson. I mean, it's infants, elderly, It didn't matter. If you had any Japanese blood, you were sent away.
And your book has a lot of great photos and of things happening at the time,
yes.
Different artifacts. It's really a beautifully published
book. The Bainbridge Island Japanese American community and I worked as a team on this, and the proceeds will go toward the construction of the memorial, the Nidoto Naiyoni Memorial on Bainbridge Island, which means let it not happen again. We're on our way. We still need money, of course, but we received approval from Congress and President Bush to associate with the Minidoka National Monument in Idaho, which is the site of one of the two camps that islanders were sent to. So we're part of the National Park Service. We're not going to get any money to build it from them, but when it is constructed, we're going to get their help on how to display the information, to get the story out in the interpretive center, and we'll have some wardens from the National Park Service that we're very appreciative of to have that association.
So how long did the residents there have to scramble to once they heard that they were going to be taken away?
Okay. Let's see. I do want to read from the extra. Would now be mm-hmm. a time to do that?
Certainly.
Okay. The day after Pearl Harbor, which was December 7, my folks stayed up all night and came out with the one and only extra, the Bainbridge Review. And it was one page. Mostly it was to get out civil defense information because the review came out on Thursdays, and that's quite a gap. They have to wait for that. So there's lots of talk about what to do when the church bells ring and don't have your lights on at night, and if you're driving your car, you can't have your lights on at night, and information like that. There also was a significant interview with the Issei, which is the first generation of Japanese, Ichi Nisan, 1, 2, 3. So Issei, first generation, Nisei, second generation, and Sansei is the third generation. The Issei are the immigrants who were not allowed to become citizens, and a lot of newspapers around did interview the Nisei, the younger, the first generation of American citizens, but I haven't seen any other paper that interviewed the Issei. I just think that's interesting. Significantly, they had a major editorial, which took up about a third of the column. I won't read all of it, but I think it is significant what they said, because my folks had an ability to see the big picture when other folks were looking at today, and this they were looking at how this is going to resolve itself with the Nikkei and the war and all of that. I'll just read part of it, but it began, if there ever was a community which faced a local emergency growing out of something over which it had no control, it is Bainbridge Island this Monday morning in December 1941. This is no time to mince words. There are on this island some 300 members of 50 families whose blood ties lie with the nation which yesterday committed an atrocity against all that is decent. And they go on to say, and in such a recoil of sentiment, there is the danger of a blind, wild, hysterical hatred of all persons who can trace ancestry to Japan. That some of those persons happen to be American citizens, happen to be loyal to this country, and happen to have no longer a binding tie with the fatherland are factors which could easily be swept aside by mob hysteria. And that was significant because that's exactly what happened. Newspapers jumped in, some certain politicians, very racist politicians, and others, and within a month, two and a half months, they had created this hysteria. The San Francisco Chronicle noted in the early part of December that people talk about war hysteria. We don't see it anywhere but among certain politicians and in the press. People are not calling for the exclusion, but within a couple of weeks of that editorial, executive order was signed, and very few people objected to it.
Now, you call it the exclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you do that?
Well, it's terminology. Internment is actually a legal process and has been recognized for centuries. It's controlled, I guess, by the Geneva Conventions. There are, if we went to war with Canada and there were Canadian citizens living in this country, we have the right to confine them. And that is a legal process. Part of the legal process is that they then have the right for judicial advice and a court hearing. Now, the FBI it's kind of convoluted. The FBI had done research on Japanese Americans for decades. They had information about people that went back to the turn of the century when they had jumped ship, when they had come to America, for what reason. And they had determined, along with two other independent investigators, that there was no threat. And Roosevelt was aware of that before December 7. He was aware that his Hoover was on the right side, and he had the white hat on as FBI director J. Edgar Hoover in 41. And he told the president, there's no threat here. The attorney general of the United States said, there's no threat here. But the West Coast congressional delegation was saying, oh yeah, we got to get these guys out of here. And that's who Roosevelt responded to. What was the thrust of the question?
Why did you call it the exclusion?
Oh yes. Okay. So when they were excluded, that happened at the end of March, and that was what eventually became the 120,000 who were incarcerated in the different camps. In December and on Bainbridge Island on February 4, the FBI, along with local sheriff and other officers, went to each of the Nikkei homes on Bainbridge. They did not have warrants. They seized material. They seized material that not only belonged to the Issei, again, the aliens, but also their Nisei children. They took shotguns and shortwave radios and dynamite and listed them as contraband when a week before, or in this case, two months before, that was considered normal. Every farmer on the West Coast had a rifle to shoot varmints or to collect dinner. And dynamite was used on the island in particular to blast the huge trunks from the lumber that had been so they could create their farmland. There were people who were arrested at that time. My feeling is that what the FBI did is effectively remove the community leaders from the Nikkei. They took all the fathers. The Nisei, that their children, the oldest on Bainbridge was Sam Nakao, who was 28, I believe. Most of them were in school. Maybe the bulk were in, just because of the laws that restricted immigration, you can trace it back, but were in high school or had just maybe graduated. But they were used to following their father. Their father was the one who made the decisions in the family, and they were used, and they removed many of the farmers. They removed the political leaders. But they were taken to internment camps. So regardless of my philosophical objections to that, it was a perfectly legal process. They were interned in Fort Missoula, most of them. There were others where our islanders were sent. They did have an opportunity for hearings, such as they were, but they did have the opportunity to challenge the charges, and eventually they were all released. But they were not released to go home. They were released to go to the camps. They still could not return to the West Coast. But so technically, internment refers to this one legal process that affected a relatively small number of people. And when it's used to refer to the thousands who were rounded up, mostly American citizens, it kind of puts a veneer of legality on it, and I object to that. I'm fighting a losing battle. It'll always be called the internment, I think, but I prefer exclusion. They were excluded. Some of them almost immediately the government began allowing people to leave the camps for work release, for instance. They had a whole beet crop, sugar beet crop in Idaho and potatoes in Montana that needed to come in. And most of the folks who would have brought in that crop were serving in the Army. Our folks couldn't bring in the strawberry crop that they had planted on Bainbridge, but they brought in the sugar beet crop and helped the economy that way. And then the government realized that not only was it expensive to keep these people confined, but it was interrupting their education. So people could, if they had a sponsor, they could be released to go to school, but they had to go east. They couldn't continue at the University of Washington, for instance. But they could not return home. So they were excluded regardless of where they ended up. They still could not go home. They were excluded from the coast for the duration.
Only a few minutes left. So what became of those folks that were forced off of Bainbridge?
Those who had, many began farming on Bainbridge after the mills closed in the early 20s. There were some that had begun farming earlier, but most of them began farming after the Port Blakely mill finally closed in the 20s, and they scattered around Bainbridge Island to many different locations and went from Yama, which was the Chinese community at Port Blakely, they scattered around the island. And so they were pretty well integrated into Bainbridge life by the time the war began. 10% of the population was Japanese American, but 25% of the high school was American, so it had a significant effect. But many of them economically were able to build their first home. They'd finally able to put money in the bank. I mean, they were just beginning to turn the corner when they were sent away. So those people who had land and had associations with others on the island were able to make arrangements, and many, many islanders came forward and helped with lots, and that's there's some wonderful stories of how islanders stored maybe rugs or dishes or whatever for their neighbors. So their neighbors were taking care of them as much as they could, and there were folks who paid taxes on the land for them. And if you had that arrangement, then you had something to come home to. The folks who were still renting by the time that the war broke out, they didn't have anything to come home to. And though they wanted to return to the island, they ended up taking a job working in a gas station in Seattle. There were some who chose not to return. There were others who said, well, the farming in Skagit Valley actually is better than Bainbridge, so the Sukumas, where we get all our wonderful berries in the summer, the Sukuma farm moved from Bainbridge to the Skagit River in Burlington and maintained associations with Bainbridge. So there were some who chose not to come back to the farming life, many of those who had an association and because they weren't earning any money in the camps, they could not have paid their taxes. You had to have an association with someone who was willing to do that for you, and there were many on the island who came forward for that.
All right. Unfortunately, 30 minutes is not enough time to really go into this.
That went fast.
We are talking with Mary Woodward. She is author of the new book, In Defense of Our Neighbors, The Walt and Millie Woodward Story. And quickly, is there a website or anything that people can connect to?
We're working on it.
Okay.
I mean, we really are. BIJAC, BIJAC, which is Bainbridge Island Japanese American Community. We're in process, and we have been working on this diligently and trying to really update it. It's not currently available. Within the next month, we expect it to be.
All right.
And there should be information there.
All right. We'll try and relay that out once we have that. So I want to thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
It's been a real pleasure, Mike. I've enjoyed this.